I think more than the numbers that we are talking about is the irritation it gives to hardworking American citizens who have lived in this country legally and who believe that they are put upon by the taxes, the weight of taxes that we have, and say, why can't I get the kind of care that I want when some other people who apparently do not live here legally seem to be able to draw down on those services that are provided by my taxes? I'm not trying to blame the illegal aliens for all of the problems that we have in our health system. That would be unfair, or for all the costs. But there is no doubt that when you're talking about that number of people within the United States who are uninsured, that a not insignificant percentage, that probably is in the millions, are those people who are here illegally. And so that goes to the question of immigration, immigration reform. It goes to the question of strengthening our borders. It goes to the question of interior enforcement. It goes to the question of being serious with other countries that don't take their people back in a quick fashion. All those things that I've been working on and talked about for many, many years, but you are right, it does have an impact on our health system and does have an impact on the cost of our health system. And that's why I say, if we're going to talk about the specific question of those who do not have medical care by virtue of the fact they don't have insurance, we've got to break that down into its subcategories and then deal with them, look at them, and see what we want to do in terms of trying to adjust for that. But don't throw out the entire system that we have now because we have a percentage of people, a percentage of that group of people that do not have access. Let's try and figure out who they are, what categories they fall into, and then attack the problem very specifically when we know what it is we're talking about. All right, let's go to another caller, and this time we'll go out to McCallamy Hill. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yep, you're on.
Hi, yes, I've got a two-part question for you.
Yeah.
The first part is, what would a government health insurance option look like that you might be willing to support? And the second part of my question is something that you had just said, and I just wanted some clarification about what you meant by implementing some health care reform may upset the entire system.
No, no. What I said was, if we in fact, what I meant to say, and I hoped I was saying, was,
oh, okay.
I think it would be a mistake for us to say we have a overall health care system in the United States which provides the best health care in the world, if you look at terms of quality, but does have some problems, particularly with respect to those who don't have insurance, for us to upset that entire program because we have a part of it which is not currently at optimum in an optimum position. And so what I mean by that is, I don't think we ought to alter the entire system because we want to deal with the question of uninsured Americans. What we ought to do is try and see if we can deal with that subset of Americans, that smaller number of Americans who don't have health care, access to health care by virtue of their insurance. They may have access to health care by going to their local hospital and so forth, with emergency rooms where people are using that as their primary care. But let's deal with that. And that's what I'm saying. If you look at the inventiveness of the American health system, including doctors, procedures, devices, pharmacological products, all of those sorts of things, I happen to think we have a better track record for inventiveness and of application of new inventions to bring forth better care than any other country in the world. I don't want to see us stifle that in a fashion. That's what I meant by that.
What would a government health insurance option look like that you might be willing to support?
Well, I don't know. I mean, because I've been trying to hear what they're talking about with respect to that. One of the concerns I have is if you start with a health care package, which is a government-sponsored health care package, and you say that's going to be up against against other private programs. The natural tendency is to provide sufficient subsidies and benefits to that government-run program so that it competes in a favorable position against those private sector insurance or private sector plans. And so what inevitably happens is you drive people from the private plans to the government plans, and ultimately you usurp the private market for the public market. We have some public plans that are already in existence. We have the VA system, for instance. That is a system that works, I think, better than it used to. I think it gives a level of care that is very, very good now. But you have a limited universe of individuals there. And in some ways, if you look at the way we control spending, it is, well, look at drugs, for instance. We have formularies. And the natural tendency, at least in government when dealing with budgets, is to make overall cuts as opposed to going in and creating incentives to make savings there. And that's basically the concern I have.
I understand that the VA negotiates for drug prices, but Medicare doesn't. And so the VA, you know, might be a little more...
Well, but if you look at the system, and I wasn't around in Congress when they voted for the Medicare Part D program with respect to coverage for pharmaceuticals, which is the largest single increase that we've had in the Medicare system over the last, 40 years. But the fact of the matter is that allows for private negotiations with the various different plans that are out there. And if you look at the projections of costs that were initially made, and again, I wasn't in Congress at the time. I wasn't there to vote on it. I have some real problems with us moving so aggressively in that area and adding that new tremendous financial burden there. But having said that, if you look at what the projected costs were, they are significantly less now than were projected at the time, in part because you've had those negotiations by individual programs and individual program managers so that you have an array of different negotiations going on rather than a single negotiation going on with the government. All right, let's go out to another call. This time we'll go out to Valley Springs. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
So far, so good. That first bill, support our troops. Yeah, exactly. How much of that, you know, when people ask for money, support your local sheriff, any of the number of the charity groups giving money or support to some seemingly worthy causes, first thing I ask is, how much of that dollar is going to go to the study of cancer or go to the pockets of the people who you say you're supporting? Which means, how much of this money that we're going to be sending to our troops is going to go to Halliburton's pocket? And how much of that is going to go back into your pocket in the form of, influence peddling?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting you mention that, because one of the things I'm perhaps most proud of is the work that I've done on something called the False Claims Act. The False Claims Act is created precisely to take care of the problem that you mentioned. The False Claims Act history goes back to the Civil War. During the Civil War, it came to the attention of President Lincoln and others in the Congress that there were certain war profiteers that were taking advantage of the war. And while we had men fighting and dying in the Civil War, we had some people supplying supplies to them that were not adequate, gunpowder that didn't actually work, horses that were lame. And so the thought was at that point in time we needed to do something to take care of that fraud. We created the False Claims Act. One of the things it does is it allows individual citizens who are able to ferret this out to actually bring an action on behalf of the government, can be joined by the federal government in this. And one of the incentives we have for people to take that time to do this sort of thing is that they get part of the recovery. This program, the False Claims Act, worked from the time of the Civil War all the way up to and through World War II. Sensenbrenner and I and others on the Republican side worked with him on that. We passed it with the support of the Reagan administration. Ronald Reagan signed it into law. It had worked well up until a couple of years ago when the United States Supreme Court, in a couple of decisions, decided that you couldn't have that law apply if, in fact, the person or the company that you were going after was not in direct contract with the United States government, and meaning that you couldn't go after the subcontractors. And you've done some reading, I'm sure, and seen some of the articles that some of those people that we thought were defrauding us in terms of our expenditures in Iraq and in Afghanistan were subcontractors rather than contractors. So just, I think it was 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, we passed legislation that I fought for, the False Claims Act. It was incorporated into an overall anti-fraud bill. And because of the work that I did on it, I was invited to the White House to see President Obama sign that law. So I am concerned, as you are concerned, that when we authorize and appropriate money, particularly, well, in any area, and the law that I worked on is not just limited to defense contractors, it includes all contractors, but specifically, if we're going to have contracts for goods and services that are supposed to support our troops in a wartime zone or anywhere, we ought to make sure that that money is spent the way it's supposed to be. And so I share your concern, and I have fought for that law. And in fact, a year ago, I was given the Honest Abe Award by an organization for really ferreting out fraud and abuse at the federal level, in large measure because of the work I've done on that bill. So I thank you for that call, and I think it's important for us to be able to assure you and everybody else that we do have watchdogs out there, and that we ought to protect watchdogs and whistleblowers and give them support. And when you have a law that goes all the way back to Abraham Lincoln, in fact, it was called the Lincoln Law when it was first passed. I'd like to call it the Lincoln Law, then updated by the Reagan revision, and now we're doing it again. This is something that really does help. I mean, billions of dollars have been saved, have been returned to the federal government, protecting the taxpayer as a result of those laws. So I absolutely agree with you. I was happy to be at the White House, invited by the president when he signed the bill. All right, let me go out now to Antelope. Hello.
Oh, it's Beverly Rubino. That's my name. And I was
Hi, Beverly. How are you?
Well, I've been very ill, and my thing is that my husband died, and I was left on disability and his pension. And they deduct my disability from his pension. And I'm living on one quarter of what my husband brought in. So I tried to get Medi-Cal. And Medi-Cal doesn't care what you have to pay for rent or what your payments are to live, to eat, to have food. I've lost 40 pounds since he died, or anything like that. All they care about is what you bring in. They don't look at what you spend, and so you're not eligible for that. So you end up with Medicare, and Medicare pays 80%. You're living on disability and your husband's pension, and they deduct disability from his pension. You still have to pay rent, you still have to pay for your utilities, and you still have debts from when he died. He worked for the railroad for 14 years as an engineer. In 14 years he worked for the railroad, they told him they'd take care of his wife. He died, I had enough money barely to take care of his death. And I'm living on his pension, and they deduct my disability from his pension. I'm legally disabled. I'm asking you. Does this system seem fair to you?
Well, let me say this. I don't talk about specific personal cases on the phone, partly because of a privacy issue. But I would tell you that if you would contact my office during the office hours, as I mentioned, we will look into this. I do not know how the disability that you are eligible for affects your husband's pension. And one of the reasons is railroad law is a unique part of the law with respect to both their pay, their health, their injury, and a number of different things. But we can certainly look into it because railroad law is actually under federal will tell you, I'm one of those who happens to believe that if we move from a income tax to a consumption tax, it would be better off, and you could handle those at the lower end of the income scale by virtue of a tax credit and a redeemable tax credit to those individuals. You could, and what you do is you figure out what the subsistence level, that is, what does it take basically to live, you know, what would be the floor, and you would return that to everybody, and so that everybody would be treated equally with respect to that. Then when you are taxed on what you buy, the wealthy buy more than the rest of us. I mean, that happens to be a fact. It also is a way of encouraging savings and investment and not encouraging as much consumption, excessive consumption, let me put it that way. Now, if you're saying that we ought to add that in addition to the income tax, I have a real problem with that, because if you look at where we are right now, California, for instance, we're one of the most heavily taxed states in the union, and you see what's happening to our economy right now. The United States, in terms of competing with other countries around the world, now has one of the highest overall rates, both in terms of corporate tax and tax on capital. And when you're talking about capital, that means people investing money. The only way we, as a major industrialized country, or as perhaps the most technologically advanced country in the world, are going to be able to compete with other countries where people are willing to work for a lot less per hour, is that we surround our workers with better and better machinery, better and better inventions, all those sorts of things that cost money. So I guess I have a concern. If you were to ask me, if I were to start over, if I were to develop a plan for taxation in this country that made a lot more sense than what we have now, it'd be a consumption-based tax, doing all those things, though, that you and I talked about with respect to protecting those at the lowest end of the income level. If you're talking about starting it up to pay for a massive new health plan that some people are talking about now will cost $1 trillion, I just couldn't go along with that. But I'm always willing to listen and to talk about these things, because I don't have all the answers. I don't know anybody who has all the answers in this regard. Okay, let's go out to Valley Springs. I'll try and shorten up my answers so we can move along to more questions. Hello? Hello? Well, I guess I scared them off. Okay, let me go to the next caller. Citrus Heights, hello.
Oh, hi. Hi, I would like to ask you a question towards healthcare as an insurance. I have a friend who happens to be a neighbor, and she has HealthNet as $100 a month, and she's on Social Security as well as I am, and she's SSI, and because she pays in to health insurance, her income has not been deducted by Schwarzenegger. I was getting $900 a month or thereabouts. Within 2 months' time, he slashed mine down to $700 a month. Now, I don't...
You're talking about the state.
I'm talking about the state, yes.
Yeah.
And so I was getting $100 and some odd, I can't remember, probably $180 some odd to make it to... But anyway, I was getting close to $900 a month, and now it's gone down to close to $700 a month. That's $200 taken away from disabled and senior citizens. And I also have a service dog. I have vet bills. I have health. I have life insurance I'm trying to take to keep on. I can't do it because... My money has been slashed tremendously, and then also I have vet bills, like I said, and then I have because I have a service dog, and we cannot survive for putting food on our tables plus rent and paying for our medical, as in prescriptions. that how are we supposed to survive? Is there anything that you can do?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I don't have a specific answer for a particular case. I mean, we can look into a particular, you know, if you have questions about the federal government with respect to programs that we have, we can look into that. With respect to the decisions being made on the state level, we basically have a financial collapse of our state government in California, and they are making some very, very hard choices right now, some of which I think will continue, others of which will not. But the fact of the matter is, at the state level, the state has been spending far more money than it takes in, and now we're at a point in which we're questioning whether or not we can go out and borrow more money, whether other people will lend us more money. When I mean other people, I'm talking about investors, I'm talking about both international and domestic investors, and if we lose that, we lose the opportunity for California to basically be able to operate on a day-to-day basis. So I know they're making some very, very difficult, tough decisions in the state of California. We do not have oversight of that. That is the state government. I think one of the things we have to do is to say to the state, as well as the federal government, we want you to establish priorities. There are some things that are more important than others. There are some things that, yes, would be nice to have, but we just can't afford those anymore. Let's get down to the basics. I'm not trying to say it's easy for the state legislature or the governor, but frankly, we've gotten in the position we're in because we've not realized that you can't spend more than you take in for a long period of time. Otherwise, what's going to happen is you're going to have all the programs suffer, particularly those trying to help people in need. Again, if it's a question about a federal program for which you're eligible, we can check into that. But it sounds like your concern is with the state, and that should be directed very specifically. I believe if you're in Citrus Heights, Roger Nilo would be your assemblyman, and they could try and at least answer your questions and see where those programs are and see how they are being implemented at the present time. Let's go now to Sacramento again. Hello.
Hello.
Yes,
me?
You're on.
Oh, hi.
Yes.
Hi. I have a couple of questions about sort of what I perceive as some of the contradictions. And I don't mean to make it personal to you, but I think the issues that I see kind of with how the Republicans are approaching health care.
Well,
our current system is an employer-based system.
Correct.
But Republicans are actually hostile to that system. So they're favoring, and the president and the insurance companies clearly favor, an individual mandate. And I work on these issues, and I get all this. So we're going, the president is moving to the right, if you will, from where the Democrats normally are, to embrace an individual mandate. The public insurer option really functions in the marketplace, Congressman, to ensure that there's not price gouging by insurers who have a captive market. You're creating a monopoly. You're telling people you must go out and buy something. The government is ordering you to buy it, and it doesn't seem very Republican to me, but this is where the Republicans are. You must go out and buy health insurance, and if you don't, we'll throw you in jail. Okay? That's basically, it's a mandate on individuals. They're resistant to doing a mandate on business, even though that is the status quo. That is the existing system. So the Republicans are really, and the insurance companies, for their own purposes, are advocating a radical departure from the current system. And the insurance companies, and I totally understand this, because they want to make as much money as possible, and they do very well, health insurance companies, as opposed to, say, providers, doctors, et cetera, who don't do as well as they used to. They resist a public option because the public option will, in effect, keep the market honest. It will ensure that there's competition when you have inelastic demand, when you force everybody to buy something. So really, that is the part of it that ensures that there's something of a free market and that there's true price competition so that your actual individual constituents, like me and all the people on
who said that she's not open to the public option because she said, and these are her words, "I think it undermines the essence of our efforts to create a market-based system with safeguards for our consumer." The new Alaska Senator Mark Begich, the Democrat, the one who won in that highly contested election, said, "I'm not sure where I fully stand at this." There's, if you look at what's being said on both sides of the aisle, and both in the House and the Senate, there is a lot of discussion about what the best approach would be, or the best elements of an approach, and there's not a consensus on the public option. I guess I'd call it that. I happen to be looking and have looked for a number of years at something which I thought would increase competition. Because you've talked about captives setting up a system that would basically make the average person a captive of the insurance companies. I happen to think if the more competition you have among different carriers, HMOs, etc., the better off it would be. That's why I have said for some period of time I would like us to investigate the possibility of state health insurance exchanges, where in fact you might be able to, in California, have access to a health insurance policy that is approved and licensed in another state. It may be different than the coverage that is in California, but it may be what you need. Now, you could enforce it under the state, insurance commissioner of the state in which you live. The issue there would be, would you having an opportunity for, say, 120 different programs rather than just those, let's say, six that may exist in the state of California, would that tend to give you a range of options which could be more tailored to your particular circumstance, number one? And number two, would the fact that insurance carrier in a particular state would have to compete with insurance carriers from all 50 states and the territories create that kind of competition that you're talking about that you believe, at least I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you seem to suggest would only be possible by having the public option. See, my concern.
I think that's actually a very valid point. I think what would probably happen, Congressman, over time, is that a lot of those differences in price are related to claims history in those places. So, and the cost of the provider cost. So, frankly, it probably.
I would agree with you that I am more likely, if I live in Minnesota, to fall and break my hip if I'm 70 years of age than I am if I live in Southern California or I live in Sacramento. So there's probably a higher rate of hip fractures in Minnesota than there are in Sacramento, and probably I would stay in the hospital longer in Minnesota than I would in Sacramento because of the possibility that I might slip when I'm recovering. So, I mean, I know that there are adjustments with respect to that. But it seems to me one of the things that causes certain costs to go up is if a particular state legislature puts more and more demands, that is, says that as a condition of you providing insurance in this state, you must provide this kind of coverage, multiple different types of conditions and so forth. Maybe that's not what I need, or maybe that's not what I want, or maybe that's not the option that I believe is necessary, but yet because the state legislature has decided that that's the ones that they want, that's the only thing I can have. If I have the greater flexibility to perhaps reach across a state line for something else, given the fact that you're going to have experiences, different experience rates, it at least would be an opportunity to increase the number of options that I have. I mean, that's not the only thing that I would look at. The other thing is this. There is a normal tendency in government to try and make the government option better than the private option, or to interfere with decisions that otherwise would be made from a true economic standpoint. I'll give you a case example. I mean, look what's happening right now with Chrysler. I helped rewrite the bankruptcy laws 25 years ago for Chapter 11, Chapter 7, and the whole idea was in Chapter 11, you would be given the opportunity to reorganize in such a manner that you might be able to have a viable business operation. We've seen that with a number of the airlines that came out of the disasters that befell them after 9/11. We've seen that with other major corporations. But yet we were told that General Motors, Chrysler were too big to fail. So instead of going through the normal process that we established under bankruptcy, where everybody puts their cards on the table, everybody is treated under the law as it was known prior to the time they found themselves in this situation, and everybody therefore is asked to take a haircut. But you preserve things such as the secured status if you are a secured creditor versus an unsecured creditor. They said we couldn't do that. And why didn't they want to do that? Because some of the people involved didn't want to be treated under the law as it was established. They wanted to be able to appeal to the President, appeal to the Secretary of Treasury, appeal to the members of Congress, both Senate and the House, and use their political leverage to be treated differently than what otherwise would be the case. That kind of model, unfortunately, is reflected too often in government activity, and my great concern is that if you would set up a system that says, no, we're not going to have the government take over here, we're just going to have a government option, inevitably, the government option would be given a preferred status. It would be given subsidies. It would be given other things such that it would attract more people from the private sector until eventually you would have a government system overall. And I think that would not be to the benefit of us. I mean, I think if you look at Medicare and if you look at the Medicaid system, they work well for their own purposes, but you can also see that we in the Congress, past Congresses, current Congress, won't step up to the plate to recognize that that system is headed for financial disaster, and we just keep loading things one after the other on it, assuming that nothing's going to change. Well, it is going to change, and I think you lose that opportunity for competition. I mean, there's a whole lot more we could say. I've got a lot more people on the line, so thanks for that call, and we could continue this discussion later. Let me go to another caller right now, however. And if you'd like to be on the call, ask a question, make a comment, just press zero, and you're put in line like everybody else. We treat everybody the same. All right, out in Sacramento. Hello. Yes, sir, you're on. I thought we had Mr. Durr on. All right. Well, I'll go to the next caller. And this time we're at Elk Grove. Hello.
Hi. You just finished your discussion with what my concerns were. I'm listening to the discussion today on the health care proposal, and it seemed to be so wonderful to people to have government and private insurance competing against each other, and that would improve things. And I'm looking at that as being incredibly naive, because eventually, with the endless supply of money that the government would have and their ability to change rules, private insurance would no longer be able to compete with them. So I think you just talked about that. So that was a comment I had about that. I would like to see more discussion about the exchanges or the pool, insurance pools or insurance exchanges, giving people the option of being able to purchase insurance, having more options available. And I'm not hearing enough about that.
Well, I think that's something that we need to do. I mean, I think that is something that we need to do to look at for competition. The point I was making, the point that you underscored in terms of having a government option or a public option, is best illustrated by what's happening right now, as I say, with General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford. Ford did not come to the government and ask for money. Ford has not asked for taxpayer bailout. But look what's happening to Ford now. I mean, Ford is trying to make it on its own. It is going to be at a competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis General Motors and Chrysler. Because what just happened? Didn't General Motors just get another $30 billion? That's not $30 billion that Ford has. Don't they have certain backings now? Won't there be a quote-unquote effort to try and save the taxpayers' investment? Well, the is now involuntarily invested in one or two auto manufacturers, but not the others. I mean, look what happened to the pension plans of the state of Indiana. They happen to own, or they happen to have lent, that is, be bond holders of one of the two major automobile manufacturers that are going through bankruptcy. And they've been told by the judgment that was made by the president and his people that they're going to lose out. They're going to take about an 87% haircut. The UAW is going to take about a 22% haircut. And yet, if you look at the law, the bondholder is supposed to have a secured or preferred status in bankruptcy, and yet they turned it upside down. And in essence, what's happened is political intervention has changed the rules of the game. And so I think what you talked about is absolutely true. I think there are ways for us to get competition out there. One of the things we could do is try and strengthen the position of small and medium-sized businesses such that they could offer coverage to their people. One of the ways you do that is establish health associations so they can be involved in that sort of thing. So, I mean, I think there are a number of things that can be done without us marching off to a public option, which I think inevitably would lead to not an option, but a monopoly in that area. And again, I happen to believe in competition, and I think competition tends to create a better services in the end, and usually leads to costs coming down, more economical production of things, more ways of being able to create the same result at a lesser price. And you know, even with these costs, and there are considerable cost increases that we've had, my goodness, in the medical care field. I mean, think about where we are now. We now have what are called non-invasive diagnostic techniques. Now, they could be an MRI. They could be a CAT scan. The reason I mention those things is years before, oftentimes, the only way you could be able to see those things is if we went through something called exploratory surgery. You rarely, if ever, hear about exploratory surgery. And I happen to think I would rather not be opened up for the surgeon to try and look and find out what's in there. It's probably better for me, for any number of reasons, to have them look at an MRI or a CAT scan. Those are things that were advances under medical science in the United States. Excuse me. All right, let me go to another call while I take a sip of water right here to try and clear my throat. And Citrus Heights, hello.
Hello, Mr. Lundgren. My question is, when is the Congress and the Senate going to do something about this government intervention? Somebody needs to step in and stop what's going on. I don't know if you can recall, just a few years back, we had a company that was sued for monopoly rights called Microsoft, and that was a complete opposite. Here was a company that was doing great. The economy was in a great state, and the people wanted the product, and the government decided to step in and say, you can't be this successful. Now when the companies aren't successful, they're going to step in and say, well, we're going to help you to be more successful. I'm very proud of Ford for not taking the bailout, and I think that what the government's doing with Chrysler and with GM is going to put such a damper on Ford, and with them already being in a problem they're at, they're just going to give all of the imports a huge advantage in this country, especially since they don't tax them the way they should when they bring their vehicles into our country in the first place.
Go back a little bit. I remember when I was in Congress the first time around, I voted against the Lockheed bailout. And the Lockheed bailout at that time was to allow Lockheed to continue to manufacture commercial airliners, and they had something called the L-1011, which was basically their wide body that competed with the 747 for Boeing and the DC-10 for McDonnell Douglas. At that time, I lived in Southern California. I actually represented Long Beach, and Long Beach had the McDonnell Douglas, the old Douglas plant, that produced the DC-10s. When the federal government came in and bailed out, and this is my analysis, when the federal government came in and bailed out Lockheed to allow them to continue airframe manufacturers for commercial airliners in the United States, Boeing on the one hand, McDonnell Douglas on the other, and would probably have allowed those two to compete successfully, and we would not have seen the tremendous rise of the Airbus that is created out of Europe. But there again, it was the United States government saying, well, Lockheed's too big to fail with respect to commercial airliners, and it was a largely a political decision. I think we have real problems when we act in that way, because political judgments, which are good in a political environment, in a governmental environment where we're doing things that the government ought to be involved in, are not the best way of making decisions when it's truly a business decision. And I don't mean that businesses are all perfect or that businesses are more moral than people in government and so forth. But what I am saying is they generally have a better idea about how to run their business. I mean, look how often the president said, I don't want to be the CEO of an automobile manufacturing company. I know he says that, but doggone it, he is. And then he tells us, he says who's the CEO is going to be. He says who the members of the board of trustees are going to be. And then all of a sudden you have people in Washington, D.C. who are elected members of Congress, both House and Senate, and the President and people in the President's cabinet deciding what kind of cars they're going to build. What is this? I read recently, I think it was a big profile in the New York Times, about the 31-year-old staffer in the White House who's basically sort of in charge of the automobile industry now. That bothers me a little bit. I don't have anything against 31-year-olds, but I doubt he'd be the CEO or the person making those decisions. Frankly, he probably wouldn't even be the guy you'd go in and ask to be the mechanic for your car. And yet, we're investing all this awesome power in individuals like that. Why? Because they happen to be in the government, as if that's the answer. Now, look, I'm not anti-government. I believe in limited government, but I believe in that limited government which we have ought to be robust government for the proper things. But we get out of that category, I think we're asking for trouble. So thank you very much for that call. Again, if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, all you have to do is press 0 and you're put in line. We don't curry any favorites here. First in, first out. And you can ask anything you want, and we don't have any screeners. So let me go out to the calls once again, this time out to Antelope. Hello? Yes, sir. Well, you know, I've got them still lined up, but sometimes they get off the call. Hello, Citrus Heights.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been listening to you guys talking about, you know, different things, and what I'm mostly concerned about is the way that they're taking the money from Social Security, and they're taking the schools away from our children, and our Constitution says that the children are, you have a right to, you know, a good education, and then these guys up here, they're getting bailed out, these rich people from AIG got bailed out, and look how they spent their money. The rest of us here on Social Security, and I've been working since I was 14 years old right here in California, and we all got our little $250, you know, which we thank Obama for. And, you know, what we spent it on, we spent it on food and clothing for our grandchildren. And I don't understand why they don't just take the per diem away from all of you people in government, and that right there would save how much money for our government. I mean, right there is where we're spending too much money. Why don't people live off their salary who are working for the government, like the rest of us off our salary, and cut out the per diem, you know, the gas that you pay for your own gas to and from work. We do. You know,
we
make $400 a week. We pay our own gas. I don't understand why the government gets all these little extra perks. That's where the waste is going. Our government is just wasting. They're acting like a bunch of you know, little kids who live in a candy jar where they can just get whatever they want instead of being responsible to the people. Because the government is for the people, by the people, and to the people. You know, that's what our forefathers set it on, and that's the way it should always be.
Well, I should just tell you, the state legislators do get a per diem, but those of us in Congress do not now, nor have we ever gotten a per diem. So we can't save any money on the federal level by canceling our per diem because we don't
hall meeting in Folsom last week.
Oh, thank you. Thanks very much.
And the first thing I wanted to say is that my father wasn't in favor of Social Security, and he kept pointing out that the federal government wasn't on Social Security, and if it was so good, why didn't they go on it? Well, the question is, if they were to go to this new health plan, would you be in favor of Congress and the Senate going on that same health plan?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, the first point that you made about your dad saying that the members of Congress are not on Social Security, that is true. When I first came to Congress, when I was elected the first time around in 1979, Congress was not in Social Security. One of the first things I did was introduce a bill to say that Congress ought to be on Social Security and ought to make contributions to Social Security like everybody else. My bill did not pass, but several years later, it did. A bill like it did pass, so it has been the law since probably about 1982 that Congress pays into Social Security and is treated like everybody else on Social Security. With respect to the health plan that Congress gets, it's the same one that all federal employees are eligible for. I happen to think it's a good program. I've heard some federal employees complain that it's not that good. Frankly, I think it gives you a number of options, and those are the kinds of options that I'd like to see Americans have an opportunity to decide on, those options and other options. That's one of the reasons why I say perhaps if you would have the ability for individuals to be able to choose among the various different policies that are available around the country, that might actually provide an opportunity for people to be able to make those judgments as to what is the best thing for them. I happen to think that different members of our society may want different types of coverage depending on their particular circumstance. But I would be one of those who would say that you ought to be able to have programs available that have the same standard health benefits as members of Congress and those other federal employees have. I don't see any problem with that because I think actually the program has proven to be rather successful. All right, let's go out to Rancho Cordova. Hello.
Hello there. How are you?
Good.
I have lots of questions, but Social Security's come up, so I'm going to hit on that one because I've been paying into it since 1971, and now, actually, just last week received a letter saying that when I get in to the point that I'm going to be receiving it, it's going to be gone. But I'm still going to have to pay it until I retire in 10 years. What's the government doing about that? What are we looking forward to all these people that have been paying into it, and now we're getting letters saying that there's not going to be any available for us? Yet, right.
Well, I don't know who's sending you those letters.
Social Security Administration.
No. There's nothing. There is something.
2041, and then you look at programs where we're giving Social Security to people that have never paid into it.
Yeah, let me answer that in a couple of different aspects. Number one, there is nothing that I know that the Social Security system saying that you're not going to have your benefits. There is an organization I know that is sending out letters saying that. What is accurate is this. The system has for most of its time, from the beginning, actually I think all the time, from the time it started up to and including the present time, taken in more money per year than it pays out per year. In other words, the amount of money that comes in this year from employers and employees in the Social Security Trust Fund that they put into the trust fund is less. paid in per year than goes out. So what will make up the difference? It is at that time that the Social Security Trust Fund will begin redeeming the IOUs. Those IOUs will continue to cover the shortfall from the current time up until about 2047, and I think under the newest calculation it's going to be about 2040 or 2041. I believe those are the numbers. At that point,
2041 was on our statement.
Okay. At that point in time, we have a serious problem, because at that point in time, the amount of money coming in from employer and employee will be the only thing that goes into the trust fund, because all of the IOUs will have been spent. And at that point in time, this country is going to have to make a terrible decision. That is, do we increase the taxes? And I'm giving you, these are general numbers. I don't have the numbers in front of me. But do we increase taxes on the employer and the employee by about 41%? Or do we cut the benefits by about 41%? Clearly, either option is an impossible option. And so what it means is we have to seriously change the way we structure that program in the outlying years, while continuing to promise those people who are retiring now or are close to retirement that there will be absolutely no change in their benefit structure. Now, this is not an easy thing to do. This, with Medicare and Medi-Cal and the other things, I think is one of the biggest issues staring us in the face, and I have, from this standpoint, never been more concerned about the future of our country. So what do we do about it? Congress has ignored it. I am supporting something that's called a bipartisan commission. It's called the Securing America's Future Economy, or SAFE Commission. It would establish a bipartisan 16-member commission to look at everything, all the way from what government's required to spend, we call that mandatory entitlements, to spending all other programs. I mean, we could talk about education, transportation, we could talk about health care, national defense, all the way to tax policy, and then to offer solutions. And no budget item in the federal government would be beyond the scrutiny of this. Then I would support this commission holding hearings all the way across the country, developing a series of recommendations with respect to try and put us on a financial footing that will not destroy us the way you've just talked about the way the Social Security system is. And here's the kicker on this. They would make a number of recommendations. I'm talking about a number of specific recommendations, and then the Congress would be required to vote those up or down. Now, what that means is that you would have the stark realities of the economic circumstance, the financial circumstance of the federal government staring you in the face. This bipartisan objective panel would have set out what the problems are, and then would have recommended specific changes, specific program changes, and then Congress wouldn't be able to move up or down on these things. It would rather have to either accept them or not accept them. We did the same thing with something called the BRAC Commission. You may recall that. That was the commission, the BRAC, where we took base realignment and closure commission. And that was set up because we, in many ways, needed to downsize the infrastructure of the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force around the country. Nobody wanted any bases closed. Nobody wanted us to retrench on that. But there was a national decision that we had to do it. So we set up this commission. They went around the country, reviewed all this, tried to make an objective analysis, and then had an opportunity for some review by the commission before they submitted their final report. It then went to the president, and then he sent it forth to Congress. Congress had to vote it all up or all down. It's the only way we got that thing done. It seems to me that might be the only way for us to be able to do what you have just pointed out we need to do, and that is to face facts. That's why I'm supporting the establishment of that commission and doing that as soon as possible. Carmichael, hello. Hello, and Carmichael. All right. Another one dropped off.
need more money spent on health care, but a large increase in knowledge provided in the education of the general population, both young and old, to stay healthy. One-third of the population is overweight. Case in point, mandatory death sentences for old drug traffickers. As regards to California, eliminate 10% of all state jobs and give the remainder a 10% salary cut, then we will be well on the way to balance the budget. Make sure all Supreme Court justices enforce the Constitution and not interpret it to their own views. Also, the government should be subservient to the people and not the other way around. And as regards Guantanamo, I think I'd either turn those people there into dog food or make them walk the plank into the shark pond, because they've got no feelings whatsoever for Americans or our way of life. That's about it.
Well, David, I understand that you used a little hyperbole or exaggeration there, but I understand your point. Let me say a couple of things. One is about prevention and wellness. There is no doubt we need to do more in this country. And a lot of that is how you create incentives and how you create encouragement for people to do make those choices. If you protect people against the consequences of their action, if you, for instance, say, well, and I'm just giving an example. I'm not sure how this would work out. But if you say, hey, insurers can't make a distinction between someone who is obese and not obese in terms of the cost structure they have for their insurance, you may be saying that you're protecting against discrimination against people who are overweight, but you also, at the same time, may be discouraging people from taking responsible actions for their health. Look, it seems to me, if you look at the facts, you would see that treatment for about five chronic diseases, heart disease, cancer, stroke, what some people call chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and diabetes, make up 75% of total health care expenditures. So if that's the case, what can you do with respect to those diseases? Heart disease, cancer, stroke, pulmonary disease, diabetes. Well, some of that's genetic, there's no doubt about it. You have the genetic dispositions to some of those diseases. Some of it is the result of things beyond your control. But some of it is the result, or at least is influenced by certain lifestyle decisions that you make. Whether you smoke or not. Whether you drink to excess or not. Whether you eat to excess or not. Whether you fail to exercise. I mean, all sorts of things. And if, in fact, that has a significant impact on the cost of medical care, we need to look at prevention, and we need to do it in a way that is compatible with our system of freedom and individual decision. And part of that is, I think, one of the ways you get at it is that you somehow create a system where people are responsible for the consequences of their actions rather than protecting them against the consequences of their actions, so that you promote responsible decision making. You know, you mentioned Guantanamo. I'm one of those who does not agree that you ought to march them off into shark-infested waters. I believe you ought to keep them where they are. The history of this country is that we've been able to incarcerate, detain, country. And then when I hear from one of my fellow members, one of my colleagues in the House, Mike Rogers of Michigan, who goes to visit our prison or detention center in, I believe it was Afghanistan, and while he's there, he finds out, by the way, that we are reading Miranda rights to those people that we basically take off the battlefield. I mean, I'm out, it's stupefying. I mean, I'm outraged by this. This is nonsense. We've never done that in the history of the United States, and we really are mistaking then the idea of a wartime scenario with the idea of a crime scene. The whole purpose is not to convict people. I mean, the prime purpose is not to try and preserve the crime scene and the evidence so that you can hold a trial. The whole purpose is to stop those people you find on the battlefield from killing you or killing your countrymen, rather than trying to convict them after the fact. So it's a whole different set of circumstances. And the idea that we're going to establish a global justice protocol that includes giving Miranda rights to people we find on the battlefield is absolutely ludicrous. And in my judgment, would tend to endanger our men and women in uniform and ultimately endanger us. I mean, I happen to think that is a very, very serious issue that we have to debate greatly. All right, I'm going to go to Rio Linda. Hello.
Yes, hello. I was going to talk about health care. I'm really disturbed by the sort of narrow focus of the discussion and how emotional it is. When the facts are looked at, there's a more than enough money for health care, but we spend 57% of the federal budget on the military, and they want more, 6% on health. And in Canada, the average Canadian lives 3 years longer than the average American, and in Cuba, the average Cuban lives longer. In Germany, they've had health care, along with 35 other countries. In Germany, they've had health care for 100-plus years, and their overhead's 6% as opposed to 21% here. Well, what's not being discussed is the 15% difference there is for the massive salaries for the CEOs. And I, as a human being, I don't really feel that there should be a debate about whether or not we should have health care. It should be a given. The idea that the people like CEOs who sit in air-conditioned offices can make a profit off of the ill sickens me. And this, you know, there shouldn't be a debate. We should have had this 100 years ago. We have the biggest economy in the world, and yet the discussion is all about how we have no money. We have no money because it's for the middle class and for the working class who don't have the power. Congress voted itself health care back in the 1970s, and then it rejected health care for everyone else. And who pays for that health care? It's the average American citizen who pays for health care for the congressmen who, you know, probably not all of them are millionaires, but I bet most of them are multi-millionaires, and yet they have subsidies.
No, you're talking about the Senate, not the House, so I guarantee you that.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for that correction. I also have to take issue with, we're probably out of time, with if we are going to incarcerate people, we need to provide the maximum of justice. If we're not going to provide justice, we should not incarcerate them.
What do you mean by that?
If we're going to lock them up and prosecute them for crimes, we need to give them the maximum advantage of the law so we have the right people and not the wrong people.
But we don't prosecute them all for crimes.
Well, you say we lock up the battlefield, but they have no army, navy, or air force anymore. These are people, in many cases, defending their streets against troops, American troops, that have come halfway around the world to shoot them. And these people are criminals that are defending their own homes.
Well, you and I have a very different idea of what we're talking about here. We have never, in a situation where we've been in a wartime scenario, ever thought that we didn't have a right to capture people on the battlefield and hold them until the end of hostilities. It's not our fault that those involved in this radical jihad against us Anyway, during World War II, when we found, I think it was six saboteurs that had landed on our shores in Long Island, FDR commissioned a military commission rather than a court, and those people were tried by the military commission, and I believe all but one were executed as a result of finding that they were spies in this country, and that they were subject to execution.
And you find that out by having a trial. You don't just hold.
No, but it was a trial. It was a military tribunal. Is the point? It was not a regular trial. I'm one of the authors of the military tribunal law on the federal government by which we believe that we should be finding out whether or not these people have. Are in fact, there's reason to hold them. That is, that they were our combatants. The other thing is,
yeah.
Pardon me?
There has to be evidence. And
yeah, but not the kind of evidence that you require in a courtroom in regular circumstances, because the battlefield's a very different situation than you have in terms of a crime scene. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to tell the regular GI that while you're on the battlefield, make sure you preserve the evidence. When you capture this person, give them the Miranda rights. Don't ask them about who their colleagues are. They're trying to kill you at that moment in time.
Are you going to prosecute based on a rumor? If you don't have